Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
An update from the Malaysian Airlines flight search, and Russia warns the United States against hasty steps in Ukraine. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Vietnamese rescue planes searching for a missing Malaysia Airlines jet have spotted two large oil slicks in the area where the aircraft vanished on Saturday. The Vietnamese government said it is sending rescue boats to the oil slicks spotted off the tip of the country. In the south, the slicks are each about 15 kilometers long. They are the first potential traces found since the Malaysian Airlines flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing disappeared today with 239 passengers and crew on board. Meanwhile, on the ground, anxious relatives are waiting and hoping for good news. VOA's Bill Ide reports from Beijing.
Authorities brought many of the family members and loved ones of those on board to a hotel in Beijing, where they waited anxiously for news. The situation at the hotel was chaotic, with family members growing increasingly frustrated. One man whose father-in-law was on board says the airline has told them nothing. And when a reporter asks how he feels about the support the airline is giving them, he says, "What do you think?" The longtime partner of one of the American passengers on board tells VOA that she is getting regular updates from the airline and has not given up yet.
As far as they're concerned, the flight is still just missing.
A spokesman for Malaysia Airlines says there is much speculation as to the fate of the plane, but nothing so far has been confirmed. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe says pro-Russian forces in Crimea have again refused entry to a team of international monitors trying to enter that part of Ukraine. After today's incident, the latest in a series of rejections by pro-Russian forces controlling Crimea, the OSCE announced the team will return to the southern Ukraine city of Kherson. Also today, Poland's foreign minister announced his country has evacuated one of its Ukrainian consulates after continuing disturbances by Russian forces. Ukraine's acting foreign minister today called for a diplomatic resolution to the crisis in Crimea and said that a diplomatic resolution is the priority, while a Crimean referendum for joining Russia was not appropriate.
Free and fair.
All right. Andrei Deshchitsia said Ukraine is open to any possibility that will offer concrete results, but emphasized that Crimea will be Ukrainian territory. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned Secretary of State John Kerry on the phone Friday against any hasty and reckless steps taken by the U.S., saying any sanctions would hit the U.S. like a boomerang. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel would give up some settlements in a peace deal with the Palestinians. In an interview taped for broadcast with Israel's Channel 2 television, Mr. Netanyahu said it's clear some settlements will not be part of an agreement, and everyone understands that. The prime minister said he'll make sure that the number of settlements is as small as possible. He also said that Jerusalem will remain under Israeli control. Palestinians want East Jerusalem as a capital of their future state. The International Criminal Court in The Hague has convicted former Congolese warlord Germain Katanga of being an accessory to crimes against humanity. Henry Ridgewell reports for VOA.
Presiding Judge Bruno Kott delivered the court's verdict Friday. He announced that the chamber declares Germain Katanga guilty as an accessory to the crimes committed on 24th of February 2003 of murder as a crime against humanity. The conviction marks only a partial victory for the prosecution, says Phil Clark, an expert on the ICC from London's School of Oriental and African Studies.
The more important charge is around whether Katanga orchestrated these massacres in Ituri province in northeastern Congo, whether he was responsible for rape, sexual slavery and the use of child soldiers. They'll be disappointed that those charges didn't stick.
Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The United Nations humanitarian chief says almost the entire Muslim population of the capital of the Central African Republic has fled after a campaign of violence by largely Christian militias. UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Valerie Amos says about 900 Muslims remain in Bangui, less than 1% of the original population of more than 100,000. Also today is International Women's Day, being celebrated around the world. The UN calls the occasion time to reflect on progress made and celebrate acts of courage and determination by ordinary women who played an extraordinary role in the history of their countries and communities. I'm Marty Johnson, VOA News in Washington. More news at voanews.com.
Good evening. This is Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
I have come a long way, and International Women's Day 2014 particularly is an opportunity because it happens at a time when we are ending the MDGs. We are looking at post-2015.
The world marks the International Women's Day.
It has been impossible to get food pre-positioned there because of the insecurity we've seen, and this now is starting to show itself in some very worrying consequences.
Thousands of Sudanese refugees in neighboring South Sudan face a severe food shortage.
Mismanagement. When I was working, even our produce, people we are waiting to collect, people we are rushing to buy, we are unable to meet up with the demands.
And we look at what happened to Nigeria's once flourishing textile industry. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Somalia, officials say at least 9 people were killed in 2 separate clashes in the southwestern Somali regions of Gedo and Bakool on Saturday. In Wajid district, the commissioner Aiden Yarshoa told VOA Somali Service that Al-Shabaab militants killed 4 civilians in the town before withdrawing. In separate fighting on Saturday morning, the allied forces killed 5 Al-Shabaab militants in Hamore village. Sheikh Mohammed Yusuf Al-Qad, the Somali government official in the area, said AU troops are advancing to Bur Dubo. These latest clashes come a day after the allied troops chased all Al-Shabaab militants out of Dahur, the provincial capital of Bakool region. Somali and African Union forces have pushed the group from several major towns in south and central Somalia, including the capital Mogadishu, but still controls other parts of the country and remains a major threat. International Women's Day, observed on March 8th, this year comes on the eve of the 2015 deadline for meeting the Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs. One of these 8 goals set by world leaders in 2000 is the promotion of gender equality and empowerment of women. The theme for this year's observance of International Women's Day is Equality for Women in Progress for All. UN Women is the United Nations entity for gender equality and the empowerment of women. UN Radio's Derek Mbata sat down with its executive director, Fumuzile Mlambo Nchuka, to get her perspectives about International Women's Day.
Well, to me personally, it means that I have come a long way. And International Women's Day 2014 particularly is an opportunity because it happens at a time when we are ending the MDGs. We are looking at post-2015. So it is a time for change, for some big and bold decisions, because we've learned a lot from implementing the MDGs and we've learned a lot from Beijing plus 20.
Can you describe some of the obstacles that you have encountered in your career?
In describing some of the opportunities, I will also highlight the obstacles. The opportunity to have been an activist meant that you were able to be hands-on in addressing and understanding the nature of gender oppression. I was able to be part of women's organization, to engage with institutions, but also to fail in some of those initiatives. But in the process, you learn. And the moral of the story there is that it's important to be involved and to be engaged.
And when we talk about activism, we are referring to the campaign against apartheid in South Africa.
The campaign against apartheid, and within the campaign against apartheid, also the campaign for gender equality, because the struggle was about racism, but it also was about gender oppression. It was about class oppression, and the ability to look at all those things simultaneously is always important.
Now, the theme this year is equality for women is progress for all. Could you explain that a bit for us?
Equality for women is progress starting with yourself. Because if more women were to finish secondary school, we would have much less infant mortality because the mothers would know how to look after their children. We know today that if women farmers were to receive the same inputs, fertilizers, machinery for agriculture, that more people would be able to have food because production of food and agriculture will be much higher. In companies that involve women at high level and engage them fully, those companies are much more competitive and profitable. In fact, amongst Fortune 500 companies, it has been argued that they are 34% more competitive than their counterparts when it comes to returning profits to shareholders.
What is the current state of progress towards women's equality?
It's mixed. We've made progress, but it's very unequal. For instance, today we have got more women that are represented in parliaments. But the fact that we've moved from about less than 10 years ago to 1 out of 10 women being a parliamentarian to 1 out of 5, it still is less than what it should be, but nevertheless, it is progress. You also have got more girl children that are in school that are progressing, but the number of both boys and girls that are still out of school is at the same time exceptionally high.
Now, how will UN Women address some of these remaining obstacles?
Some of these obstacles are being addressed through our normative work. The policies that we advocate for, the resolutions that we facilitate, be it in the Security Council or in the General Assembly, but also the legislation that these translate to at country level. And beyond legislation, the role that our country offices play in assisting governments to implement the legislation.
Let's talk about men's attitudes and what is usually referred to as the traditional values when it comes to gender equality. What impact do these have on your efforts to advance
women? Massive impact. Massive impact. And part of it is that we probably have not engaged men enough. The women's movement has led the struggle, very bold, very courageous. But because the change that is required, the respect of human rights of women is not just something that is the responsibility of women alone. We need to mobilize and to involve men. We need them to play an effective role. In the same way that we say women are more than half of the world population, the men form the other half.
Right.
We also cannot leave that other half. And we want men to own the problem. Progress for women is progress for all. So on our side as women, it is also about changing the narrative so that we constantly communicate and demonstrate that this is a struggle where everybody wins.
And your main message for Women's Day?
Well, for one, I think it's important that women celebrate themselves. But also it is important that we don't only speak to each other, preach to the convicted, that women go out there and we win more allies for our struggle.
That was from Zile Mlambo-Nchuka, Executive Director, UN Women, a UN entity for gender equality and the empowerment of women. She spoke with UN Radio's Derek Imbata in New York. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch is appealing to Malawi's government to address what it calls widespread child and forced marriage in the country. The Global Rights Watchdog says Malawi needs to set a lawful minimum marriage age to protect girls from abuse. Government officials say efforts are already underway to address that problem. Lameka Masina reports for VOA from Blantyre.
Government statistics show that half of the girls in Malawi marry by their 18th birthday, with some as young as age 9 or 10 being forced to marry. This is attributed to factors that include pressure from the family members, pregnancy or poverty. The statistics also show that between 2010 and 2013, nearly 30,000 girls in primary school and 4,000 girls in secondary school dropped out due to early marriage. During the same period, another 14,000 primary school girls and 5,000 secondary school girls dropped out because they were pregnant, contributing to the already high illiteracy rate for women, currently at 57%. In its report, Human Rights Watch is asking President Joseph Banda's administration to support efforts that would help curb early child marriages. Agnes Odhiambo is the African women's rights researcher at Human Rights Watch.
The government needs to set a very clear minimum marriage age, and it has that opportunity because in 2006, it developed the Marriage, Divorce and Family Relations Bill. In short, we call it the Marriage Bill. But 8 years down the line, it remains a bill, and this is not a good sign that the government is committed to ending child marriage and protecting girls from the abuses that they face as a result of child marriage.
Odhiambo says child marriage exposes girls to domestic and sexual violence. Health workers say early pregnancy can lead girls to suffer from obstetric fistula, anemia, and other complications that can cause death of the baby or a mother. The principal secretary in the Ministry of Gender, Children and Social Welfare, Mary Shawa, told VOA that as government awaits passage of the marriage law, it has engaged in other efforts to end early marriages.
We are working with the chiefs to make sure that they develop their roles in their own areas, prohibiting child marriages and child pregnancy. The chiefs are going to provide penalties.
Malawi's senior tribal chief, Chief Chitera, is among traditional leaders who have introduced bylaws against early marriages. She told VOA that the bylaws penalize any traditional leader or parent who authorizes the marriage of a girl younger than 21 years of age. Chitera says the chiefs are penalized by paying 7 goals to her. She says parents who force their children into marriage would be fined to pay 3 chickens to their village headman and a goat to her as the traditional authority. Chitera says there have been no cases of child marriage since the adoption of the bylaws in 2012. The existing marriage laws in Malawi allows girls to marry as early as 15 years, provided they have parental consent. The revised marriage bill would put the minimum of 18 years as a marriage age, which Odhiambo of Human Rights Watch says conforms to the international standards. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
The UN Refugee Agency is warning that tens of thousands of Sudanese refugees in neighboring South Sudan are facing a severe food shortage. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency is helping to care for 130,000 refugees from Sudan's embattled Blue Nile state. They are living across the border in South Sudan in camps in Maban County of Upper Nile state. Maban County is not directly affected by the ongoing conflict in South Sudan, but UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says insecurity and border restrictions along supply corridors have prevented the delivery of relief items since the beginning of the year. He tells VOA it is urgent to get food into the refugee camps before the onset of the rains, which will render roads impassable.
It has been impossible to get food pre-positioned there because of the insecurity we've seen, and this now is starting to show itself in some very worrying consequences. Real shortages of food, glowing rates of global and severe acute malnutrition. We are particularly worried the impact this may have on people who, as they move, because if you move across from there towards Ethiopia, for example, the conditions are difficult, the route is difficult. It is likely that people arriving in Ethiopia, should they come there, will be in a much worse state still.
Edward says about one-third of the refugee population is at greatest risk. It includes children under 5, pregnant and lactating women, elderly, the disabled, and those who are chronically ill. He notes the rains normally start in April and warns that waterborne diseases, malaria, and respiratory tract infections will increase.
In recent weeks, we have seen several cases of kwashiorkor among very young children in the refugee camps. Kwashiorkor is a form of severe malnutrition to do with protein deficiencies. Food shortages could lead to conflict, too, between refugees and host communities foraging for wild fruits and vegetables. Already, we have seen tension over grazing lands, over access to open water sources.
The World Food Program has been providing normal food rations for the refugee camps, but the agency says the crisis in South Sudan is making it extremely difficult to access this region and resupply the camps. Because normal supply routes are disrupted, WFP says it will be using a combination of airlifts and airdrops to replenish the stocks in Maban County. An estimated 739,000 people in South Sudan have become internally displaced since fighting erupted in mid-December. The World Food Program so far has provided food to more than 420,000 conflict-affected people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Angela Peabody says gender-based violence is a subject that must be elevated to a whole new level to obtain the action needed to quell the problem. Her novel, When the Games Froze, was published in December 2013 to help create that impact. The Liberian author and sought-after public speaker on women's empowerment and gender-based violence believes the book will help American audiences understand a major issue putting African women at risk, that is a female circumcision. VOA intern Eva Flomo reports.
Angela Peabody wrote her first novel in the United States about 20 years ago, during the time of Liberia's coup d'etat and civil war.
I could not at the time put actual events, actual names to the story when I started writing it. Therefore, I decided to fictionalize it. And since my first novel led me to do that, I just continued with the second one, When the Games Froze.
The new book was based on her research in Liberia on female circumcision, which entails the removal of the woman's clitoris. Peabody says she learned that FGM, which causes pain and sometimes infection and death, is not a medical necessity.
What prompted me to write the story in When the Games Froze is being exposed to it in Liberia, knowing people that it was done to. And then when I came to America, I met women to whom it had been done. And they told stories about how they had to escape from their villages to keep from being married off to a man who was three times their ages after they had been circumcised or mutilated.
She says she wanted to use fiction again to educate Americans about the practice.
They think that it was something that was done in the old days, but as you and I speak, there are 8,000 girls in Africa that are being cut. Their genitals are being cut and mutilated. My organization and I have made it our passion to raise awareness in the United States and around the world so that we can help end it.
Can her book, When the Games Froze, influence her American audience to give the needed assistance sought in ending this risky traditional practice for Liberian women? Peabody is optimistic.
Whenever I have spoken on it to audiences in America, they are appalled learning that it's being done to little girls. The question is, how can we help? What can we do? They want to help. They want to see it stop.
Angela Peabody knows that getting the Africans and Liberians to understand and empathize with victims of FGM will require educating the younger generation.
The approach that my organization and I are taking is that we're not going to go forcefully and telling them, you must stop it. It's wrong. And this is an old culture. But I believe that education is the key. And that's where the book also comes in. Educate the girls and the boys now, and they will not want it to be done.
To ensure success in her campaign to eliminate FGM, Angela wants to learn from other countries in West Africa, where the practice is highly prevalent.
In Cameroon, there's a female judge who took the approach where she opened a center where she could encourage the women who perform FGM to come and to replace their blades with something else to do. And you have to have a center where you will train them if they are willing to do it. You can teach them how to do other things than just cutting little girls.
Readers empathize with Nana, Peabody's central character, to build reader support for ending the practice.
Nana comes to the United States to further her studies at university, and she meets these Americans and Europeans. But FGM was done to Nana when she was 5 years old. She doesn't tell anyone until it is exposed and she breaks down and reveals to them why she doesn't date men. So Nana creates real sympathy from the reader. People want to connect with her.
Peabody says she will use proceeds from the book to build an educational center in her native home, Liberia, to eradicate FGM.
Every dime that we make from the book will go toward Global Woman Peace Foundation for us to build that educational center in Liberia. That's where the money will go.
For VOA News, I'm Eva Flomo in Washington.
Nigeria's once flourishing textile industry collapsed years ago. Now some former factories are decaying from lack of use. Some blame the closures on Chinese products, others on mismanagement and lack of government support. For VOA, Heather Maddock reports from Kaduna.
For the first time in more than a decade, these former textile workers are touring their old factory. Machines are decaying, and bits of cloth and other junk litter what used to be one of the largest factories in Nigeria. Wardum Simdek is chairman of the Coalition of Closed Unpaid Textile Workers in Kaduna.
Here in Kaduna, there's no any other job that these people are doing. The only job we are doing here is Okada's job. These people that ride motorcycle here and there. And at the end of the day, some of them, they got accident, they died.
Most of the clothes for sale in Nigeria are imported from China. Industry leaders say their low cost helped drive the textile factories out of business. But they stress that corruption, mismanagement, and lack of resources are equally to blame for the industry's collapse. Umar Mohammed, the former deputy secretary of the Textiles Workers Union, says they warned the government for years that without help, the factories would close.
Then at last, the industry will start collapsing one by one. To the extent today, in Kaduna, we have only or two industries working, textile industry.
At the factory, former workers say about 9,000 of their ranks are waiting for back pay in Kaduna alone. And they insist that if the factories reopen, the locally made clothes will outsell the lower cost imports.
It was just mismanagement. Mismanagement. When I was working, people our produce, people we are waiting to collect, people we are rushing to buy. We are unable to meet up with the demands.
Workers say failed industry in Kaduna affected more than the economy. This bridge separates Kaduna City, which is divided like the country as a whole, with mostly Christians in the south and mostly Muslims in the north. Clashes between the two groups are common. But former textile workers and their families say the violence is fueled by poverty that has intensified since the jobs disappeared. They fight for even small sums of money.
No help. Everybody is going up and down. Everybody have mind their business. Because we don't have. That's why everybody is going up and down to fight to get something to eat.
Former textile workers say they will continue to protest outside the old factories and lobby for back pay. But returning to their jobs, they say, is still the dream. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Kaduna.
You love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000, and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. And then we'll have a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Yang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. But now it's time for our Saturday Music Spot, and for that, just sit down, relax, and enjoy.
Tamukati, Leloko Bakisa, Tamukati, Tamukati, Leloko Bakisa, Tamukati, Tamukati, Leloko Bakisa, Tamukati, Mama, Tamukati, Leloko Bakisa, Tamukati, Tamukati, Leloko Bakisa.
Yes, that was our Saturday Music Sport. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Douglas, it's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections with your audience in the Voice of America. This week, there are a number of issues bothering me with regard to American relations with Africa. One issue which is going to occupy our attention between now and the meeting organized by the President of the United States with the African leaders. In order for U.S. policy to be effectively carried out with regard to American policy towards Africa, people have to go back and look at the origins of American policy towards Africa. If you want to go back to history, you can go to 1884 and the Berlin Conference and the scramble for Africa, as many historians will say. You come all the way back. There are enough historians in Africa as well as in the United States to pay attention to that. The reason why a historical narrative is imperative is because the fact that President Obama is of African descent, and his presidency has many historical implications with regard to American relations with Africa. It has consequences for white Americans looking back in their own history. It has implications for African Americans with regard to the Middle Passage and the experiences of black people from Africa in the Americas, whether in Canada, in the United States, and South America. And what is very striking is the fact that you have a Pope from Argentina. So if you move from Canada all the way to Argentina, the whole experience of the new Pope, the whole experience of missionary activities in Africa, and now the assumption of the President of the United States by a person of African descent. This is why the meeting between the President of the United States and the African leaders is significant. For those who are historically oriented, connecting the historical dots to understand this long line of meaning. The second point that is critical with regard to the news media is the struggle for freedom in Africa, the struggle for freedom around the world. Because if you go back to the Berlin Conference, you can look at what was the nature of freedom and justice before the Europeans came in Africa, and what is the nature of freedom and justice in Africa since colonialism. Africans had to deal with colonial rule. They have to deal with African tyrannies before the Europeans and after. They have to deal with communism, which was trying to bring justice to the world. Of course, they failed. That movement collapsed. And, of course, today, the Africans are now entering a moral and cultural revolution. The whole question of man and woman relations, where Africans like the Jews of ancient times and medieval people used to grapple with the nature of the family. What is a family? Today you have some British sociologists and others trying to give you 120 definitions of what a family is. And this is a big issue for the Africans today. Because if you deal with America, America affects Africans in many ways. They jump up and down with their cell phone from their villages to their cities and towns, and they go back to their diaspora. All these things are part of the nature of America's relations with Africa. So when the Africans look at the relationship with America, they have to look at the historical narrative, which I assume many of the bloggers will be dealing with in their blogging all over the continent and around the world. So the question of the moral and cultural imperative with regard to American-African relations is going to occupy a lot of attention now. The third issue comes to the question of markets. The economy is stupid. And thirdly, state building and nation building. This third issue has consequences for American policy towards Africa. A lot of the women have been very concerned about the way women were treated around the continent during the Victorian age. There are a lot of books and articles written by African women, European women, Western women generally, and Asian women trying to understand, and Latino women trying to understand the question of the woman. This is all linked to economics, labor power, and the use of labor. It has consequences for the moral and cultural implications of Africa. So if we are talking about the economy stupid is both for Americans and for Africans and the rest of the world. The banking system and the manner in which we bank and the way our banks operate have consequences for Americans, Western people, the Chinese, etc. And this is where American-African relations is now coming to a very interesting point. For the Africans, it is becoming increasingly remittances, because you have more Africans sending billions of dollars from the diaspora to their home countries. And unfortunately, what they are sending is greater than the foreign investments in African countries. Until recent Chinese and early Japanese and Indian intervention. This is why American leaders have to pay close attention to what is going on in Africa. We can talk about human rights and civil rights on the African continent, but we have to pay adequate attention to how we spend our dollars in African development. Not through money is going to AIDS, which was significant. It changed the lives of a lot of people. The Bush administration, before it handed power to President Obama, took a lot of joy and glory in their activities in Tanzania, Uganda, etc. The big point is here. the Obama administration is facing some serious issues with regard to industrialization of Africa and the development of energy in that continent. In the next 3 years of the Obama administration, we can lay the foundation for a new beginning with regard to African industrial development. It is not a one-way street. It is not an American joining into Africa. Good day, Douglas and the audience.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of us here at Nightline Africa, we thank you for joining us tonight. And I'm Douglas Impuka in Washington, wishing you a fruitful weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In many countries around the world, journalists intent on telling the truth about repression, corruption, and criminality must risk their liberty and their lives to do so. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 2013 was the second worst year on record for journalists, with 211 imprisoned and more than 100 killed. In a memorial speech in honor of slain American journalist Daniel Pearl, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power underscored the critical importance the United States places on a free media and the duty of governments to ensure access to information, in part, crucially, so that governments can be held accountable to their citizens. But, as Ambassador Power pointed out, many governments try to corrupt, intimidate, and manipulate the press. Their methods include bribery, parceling out licenses to friends or others willing to practice self-censorship, imposing strict limitations on the internet and social networks, hiring intermediaries to harass and attack reporters and editors, and enacting laws that equate criticism of the government with subversion, terrorism, or treason. Ambassador Power cited several examples, including the case of Chinese reporter Liu Hu, who was arrested in September for defamation after urging authorities to investigate a local official, the arrest of Al Jazeera correspondents in Egypt, and the case of Ethiopian journalist Eskinder Nega, who continued to work online after his newspaper was closed and was arrested and imprisoned in 2011 for protesting the arrest of other journalists under a sweeping new law. From Eritrea and Iran to Ukraine and Venezuela, there are many comparable stories, said Ambassador Power. But, she noted, as Thomas Jefferson affirmed 225 years ago, freedom of the press is the best means of ensuring that all avenues of truth are open to individual citizens, and the United States has made support for press freedom one of the core and recurring themes of U.S. diplomacy. Each day, in ways public and private, U.S. officials make known our backing for the right of people to speak, publish, broadcast, blog, tweet, and otherwise express themselves openly and without fear, said Ambassador Power. After all, she stressed, defending freedom of the press is but one element of a larger struggle, a duty to be advocates for the rights and dignity of every human being.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What
What's Happening Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.